White Labs. Då ska vi träffa det här företaget som är så viktiga för hembryggningen världen över nästan.
Mm.
White Labs.
White Labs ja.
Ska vi till nu. Och kolla läget lite.
Mm.
Prata lite om
gäst,
tänkte vi. Precis. Och om deras gäst historia och lite blandat, gött blandat på deras headquarter.
Mm. Ja, deras taproom verkar lite spännande, för de gör, som jag fattade så gör de ju, brygger ju öl där och sen så splittar de och jäser liksom med två olika gäst eller fler kanske.
Exakt, ja.
Och så serverar de väl det där.
Ja.
Så att man kan...
Så ska det vara.
Det är ganska ambitiöst.
Verkligen.
Verkligen ambitiöst, ja.
Och kanske inte så intressant för alla som bara vill gå och dricka en öl, men,
nej, men, hjälp, men
för oss är det ju askul.
Ja. Ja,
det känns ju som drömmen för en hembryggare att få gå och testa sådana splitbatcher liksom.
Ja. Gäst. Så vi hoppas väl att vi kan få göra det lite... Ja.
Också.
Framför micken också, va?
Mm.
Framför micken. Bakom micken.
Bakom micken.
I micken.
I micken. Till micken.
Tror ni Chris White är där och tar emot oss?
Jag vet inte. Är det liksom där de jobbar? Eller för det här White Labs Brewing Company ska vi till. White Labs och Taproom. Är det samma ställe? Är det...
Det får vi se.
Ja. Det hade varit kul att se honom.
Mm.
Kanske.
Kanske.
Kanske kul att se honom. All right.
All right, kör vi.
Let's go.
Aye.
Halleluja.
That's nice.
Yeah. Does it sound nice?
Does it almost as good as a can of beer opening.
Yeah.
Best sound in the world. And we just opened two different beers here.
Yeah.
With?
Yeah.
Eric. That's...
Yeah, we're at White Labs in San Diego in your brewing facility.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Thanks for coming so far to talk with us today.
Yeah.
Thanks for hosting us. We're very happy. So... I guess we're jumping right into today's topic. We're talking about
White Labs.
White Labs.
Yeah.
And yeast and yeast management. And I guess we will talk a bit about split batches.
Yeah, definitely. We're here to spread the gospel of yeast, which is often the most least understood ingredient and part of the process of making beer. So maybe we can demystify it a little bit for your listeners through us enjoying beer today. They can, taste through us.
So maybe a quick introduction. Eric Fowler.
Yeah, my name's Eric Fowler. I'm the head of education here at White Labs. I've been here going on 9 years. I've been fortunate to be in craft beer for over 12 or 13 now, working at different big regional breweries, small nano breweries. I've been an avid home brewer pretty much this entire time. As we all know, as home brewers, sometimes that... You know, phase comes where it hits you real hard for 6 months, and then you can't stand it anymore, and your keezer's full of too much beer, and you let it sit for another 3 months. But you know, over probably 15 years, I've been actively homebrewing and part of this great industry since.
Yeah, great. Yeah, you definitely can feel that. We talked about that the podcast as well. Being up, having your ups and downs in homebrewing, like it comes and goes. But in the brewing industry, you had the different positions in brewing, or have you been working with education the whole time at breweries as well?
Yeah. So the first brewery I worked at, I actually started selling wine in a retail shop for a couple years prior, and I think I would still be in the wine industry, although, you know, I get to touch on that a little bit working at White Labs, but I think I would still be selling wine if it weren't for a world-class bottle of wine is, you know, $30 USD, whereas a world-class bottle of beer is two. You know, I'm not saying beer can't be a premium product, but it's just so much more accessible. And each night, you know, when I went through that journey, is I would go on Beer Advocate in the late 2000s, and every night buy a new bottle of beer that I'd never heard of the style and didn't know what it was, never heard of the brewery, and was, you know, tried these flavors that I didn't even know could exist in beer. It wasn't until my aunt came over for a holiday and left a Carl Strauss Amber Lager, which is a pretty big brewery here in San Diego. They don't make the beer anymore, unfortunately, but an Amber Lager in our fridge. And I, you know, went back up to my parents' house, saw it in the fridge. I'll try this. I didn't think I liked beer, and popped it open. I was like, wow, this tastes like caramel and bread crust and dough. And it was a pretty eye-opening experience. At that same time, Stone Brewing Company, which I had the, you know, fortunately, I was able to work for them for a couple of years, had their IPA that was so bitter and grassy, and, you know, just to be a little crass, I was like, these burps taste good, whereas the Coors and Budweiser, not so much. So I worked for a small nano brewery after selling wine, where it was myself and the owner, and you know, we were about one hectoliter, and we would do everything from brewing together to selling to working the tap room. And I quickly realized that the brewing on a professional side wasn't what I was passionate about. I was passionate about talking about beer. And so I went to work for Stone Brewing Company. I opened up one of their tap rooms, and then a position opened at White Labs, where I was still working full time at Stone. I started working here one day a week, and the rest is history. I've been fortunate to, you know, be able to build an education department, and we do professional workshops, and, you know, get to interact with great fellows like yourself.
Oh, nice.
Should we try these beers here?
Yeah.
What do we have in our glasses in front of us?
So our brewery, we have three breweries now. The two that we're brewing beer on at the moment. But here in San Diego, we have a 24 hectoliter four vessel system, which y'all were able to see, which is pretty awesome. But it's primarily used to make wort for yeast production, right? You know, essentially those big starters that everybody's making at home, we're doing on a massive commercial scale. So once, twice a week, we're able to brew a beer using the same equipment, on the hot side, that is, on the brewery. And then we bring it over to the cellar, where we have 16 5 hectoliter fermenters. So what we do is we split batch everything, much like a lot of home brewers do, and we will take 10 hectoliters of wort and then split it into 2 5 hectoliter fermenters and inoculate each fermenter with a different yeast strain. So what we have in front of you today are a couple examples of that hopefully we'll walk through. The first one, which tends to be the most difficult to distinguish, is our summer lager. It's a Czech style Pilsner, but the name summer lager just entices a little more emotion than a 10 Celsius or 10 Plato Pilsner, at least in Southern California. and so we have the same beer with two different yeast strains. And, you know, I encourage everybody to look at the beer, smell them, taste them, look at perceived bitterness, obviously aroma and flavor, but so many other aspects of the beer change just using a different yeast strain. With that said, lager strains are very similar in their expression compared to an ale strain, right? If I had an English strain and a Belgian strain side by side, the difference is night and day. When you have two lager strains, fermenting them very cool inhibits a lot of metabolite production, so it keeps it cleaner. But with that said, I get a pretty big difference in these two, so I'd be curious to get your opinions on it.
Yeah, I can feel one difference in the nose. One that was obvious for me.
The two strains that we have on these are Czech, I'm going to butcher this pronunciation, Budweis lager yeast, which is the WP802. Very common Pilsner Czech type strain. And then we have our German lager yeast on the right, which is WLP830. So they're both pretty popular commercialized strains, but they are, I think, very different in the resulting beers.
Yeah, I think that you can also think that you talked about bitterness. I don't know if you have the like correct answer, but I felt that one of them, I get more bitterness from one of them.
Me too. Yeah.
And one maybe pronounces some more breadiness or the malt backbone more than the other, or
I guess you think that the number two is more bitter.
No, I thought number one was more bitter.
Okay. I thought number two was more bitter.
Oh, man. Yeah.
And the number one was a little bit rounder, but I think it feels dry anyway. But I feel the bitterness more in the second one. Same and here, especially in the nose, I feel more
Sulfur
in the nose on the second one.
Oh, really? I get more sulfur on the first one. Okay. So maybe we swapped our samples at some
no,
point.
No.
I think I get
but more
sulfur.
But I was waiting
sulfur.
For somebody to say sulfur.
Yeah, I yeah. get more sulfur I, in the I, second one as yeah, well.
I can feel a little bit in the number one, but more in the second one.
In the second one?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely more in the second one.
Yeah, I feel yeah. more in the second yeah. one as well. Yeah.
And sulfur is an interesting compound too, in the sense that CO2 can actually lift it out of solution, mm. right? So as these beers sit here, as we agitate them and build head, it actually is blowing off some of those sulfur compounds. You notice in packaged wine a lot, they package with a lot of sulfur. And when you first pour a lot of lower end wines, you'll actually get a lot of sulfur in the glass and it just dissipates very quickly.
I think the sulfur, for me, it makes it much more German mm-hmm. than Czech. I think I connect sulfur more with German pils than with Czechian pils.
I have nothing wrong with you know sulfur in the, this amount for me. It's,
no, no, I don't say that. I think it's
for me sulfur. It, sulfur is good, you know is an indication that this is a fresh lager yeah. beer and.
I'm not saying that I have any problem with it. Only that, that I can feel it.
Yeah, very to style, yeah. But noticeably different.
Yeah,
between the two. Yep. You will get differences in perceived bitterness. This example finished pretty similarly, but if you have a really high ABV with different attenuation rates, you know, you might get one with a little bit higher finishing gravity. That's going to change the way you perceive bitterness. Yep. If they're carbonated to different levels, if it's a different temperature. Right. If there's any adjuncts, there's measured IBUs and there's calculated IBUs, which are great from a brewing standpoint. But when it comes to sensory, it doesn't always tell the full story.
No. Oh, that's true.
Great pilsner.
Yeah, really good pilsner.
It was weird. Exactly what I needed right now. Yeah.
So you're... educational program. We just walked by the like kind of a classroom mm-hmm. downstairs. And do you host like for homebrew clubs or is it the educational part? Is it for brewers as well? And or who do you educate? If I yeah,
it's a mixture of both, right? Yeah, yeah. So. Well, it's a mixture of homebrewers, professional brewers, and just hobbyists, or hopefully somebody that maybe comes in and wants to enjoy a pizza in our tap room, right? And they then realize, like, wow, yeast is not only impacting the pizza dough that I'm eating, mm. but the beers that I'm drinking too.
Are you making the yeast for the pizza also?
Yes. Yeah. We use Kveik yeast. Nice. So WLP518 Opshaw Kveik. Yep.
Yeah.
Which adds a little bit of acidity. It's relative, the fermentation on the dough, and we could talk dough all day, but the fermentation on the dough is longer than a commercial baking yeast, but commercial baking yeast, just like brewing yeast up to a certain point, was really commoditized to performance, right? It's like, can we make this cheap and can it make whatever end product very quickly? And what we really saw with craft beer or certain types of craft distillation or artisan baking is the trying to understand the organisms that are used to make these products and how much they can impact flavor and differentiate it, right? It really does matter. And the yeast strain you choose, it can be difficult because you brew with it once and then maybe you change the parameters you use it in to coax different flavors, right? Maybe it's a higher gravity, a different wort, a different oxygen, which is going to change the way it expresses itself too. But there's a lot of variables to create really unique products if you're open to using different types of strains.
No, it's fine. Fine. Just open the window in here, so...
They just make me so nervous.
Yeah, no, relaxed.
It's just beer.
Just beer, yeah.
Yeah, we have dedicated classroom spaces here in Asheville as well. And we do like hobbyist tasting classes, you know, where we just have the public come in and we'll have our chef come out and do pairings. And it's all themed around fermentation, though. So we're saying, how does fermentation impact whatever, you know, whether it's kimchi or some fermented hot sauce, or most obviously the beers that we're serving. But just last week, we did a 3-day workshop of professionals. We had brewers from all over the world, from Southeast Asia to the northeastern United States all come to town for 3 days to spend time with our education team and, you know, learn how to establish a quality assurance program, quality control program, or just better handle their yeast. You know, we're White Labs is a partner with all of our brewers, and maybe we try to extend that partnership through any way we can, whether it's YouTube videos or blogs or educational classes or podcasts.
Yeah. No, I have one of my favorite. I have linked it to people, I think, in our podcast as well. It's an old educational video with Neva Parker. I think. Yeah. That's been like, I picked up a lot of those videos from White Labs.
And yeah, which one is it?
I think it's one where she talks at
Northern Brewer.
Yeah,
that one's pretty old.
But it was, you know, it was, I can still remember it, you know, and I still think about it sometimes.
Yeah.
So it's a good impact. Yeah, because, you know, White Labs has been in Sweden since like almost the get-go. I've been homebrewing for like almost 20 years and White Labs has almost been there in Sweden as well since the start, I would say, in my brewing career. What about you guys?
Yeah, since we started to brew later than you.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But I was a bit hesitant to go over to liquid yeast. It took me a few years. I was stuck with dry yeast, which we saw today that you've started dabbing with as well.
Yeah, we have. You know, White Labs has never been opposed to dry yeast, but we have pretty high quality standards for our products. And fortunately, dry yeast has made a lot of advancements. And there are, you know, a lot of benefits, but there are also a lot of benefits to liquid cultures as well, like variety and the process of propagation is much different when it comes to dry versus liquid. And the resulting beer can change a little bit too, based off of some of our R&D. But dry yeast is finally at a point where we felt, you know, it would offer a solution to brewers globally. And still be able to get specifically California ale yeast at this point, and then London Fog in the next couple of weeks here as well.
So what's the difference on your California ale yeast from other?
So our California ale yeast is genetically different than comparable strains. We've done full genome sequencing on a lot of our catalog and, comparable Cal ale type strains. And there is some genetic difference. What that actually results in can just depend, but you'll often see a specific characteristics of the way that the yeast behaves in a fermenter, such as, you know, consistent flocculation characteristics and the flavor production, although minimal for that strain, is very clean and accentuating of other ingredients.
And I think it's a lot of homebrewers as well that they really don't understand the drying, because I think a lot of homebrewers, they think, you know, why don't we just dry every yeast?
Yeah.
And that's because it's you can't dry every yeast, and not every yeast is suitable for doing that. Isn't that right? You can't. There is some downsides with drying yeast as well. You know.
Yeah. Correct. I mean, it's anytime you're, you know, removing water from anything, you're dehydrating it. Just think about milk, you know, powdered milk. When you rehydrate it, the essence of that milk is somewhat lost. And yeast being a microorganism, there's a lot of complex functions within that cell. So when you dehydrate it, it leads to potential of damaging the yeast itself. So when you rehydrate it, it might not perform the same way in terms of flavor. We've done a lot of blind R&D, and we had a beer on in our tap room where we're at today pretty recently, right before launching it. We've done it over the years where it's labeled R&D. We don't disclose which strains what, if it's whether it's dried or liquid. And it was pretty split. We had a lot of guests that would come in that would really like the dry version. We had a lot that really liked the liquid version. But based off my personal experience, every blind panel I've gone through, that you can try the liquid versus dry, I've been able to distinguish the two. And personally, I've always preferred the liquid just because of the clean expression of it. Sometimes you can tell behavioral differences. The dry tends to not flocculate quite as well initially. So depending on how you're processing your beer, you might have a little bit more turbidity or haze, to a very small amount, not hazy IPA, but you might see a little bit more yeast in suspension than the liquid version. But there's a lot of variables too. Dry yeast is gonna withstand in that package a lot longer. So that's, fresh versus fresh. But if you have 12-month-old liquid yeast, it might not perform as well either. Yeah. So,
yeah. But this process of drying yeast, is that mostly for the commercial side or for the homebrewers, or a little bit of both? Or
To be honest, yeah, most yeast manufacturers don't really care about brewers very much.
All right.
Most of them are making yeast for bread making and bioethanol fuel production.
You're right.
So there are these massive plants on the dry side that make, again, commoditized yeast for one singular purpose. And they happen to use the same process and equipment very similarly to make brewing yeast and to make baking yeast. When you look at baking yeast on a store shelf, it's still the same genus and species as brewing yeast, the Saccharomyces cerevisiae. So it makes sense that they would cater to brewing as well, but that's a very small percentage. For an example, I was at a pizza conference earlier this year, and one of the major dry yeast manufacturers was there, and I went to talk to them a little bit and say, hey, I work for White Labs, and they had no idea who White Labs was. And I'm not trying to toot our own horn, but you go into almost any brewery in the world and say White Labs, they're going to know at least who we are to some extent. But the dehydration process isn't great for most strains. So the hardy strains, it makes sense that they're able to withstand that strenuous process. But when we're talking about the liquid side, it's almost small batch in comparison, right? We're talking about hundreds of liters as opposed to hundreds of hectoliters. And this small batch is able to tailor to each individual strain's needs. Maybe it needs a little bit longer to propagate or concentrate as opposed to another strain. And it's able to give the brewer a wide variety of strains to work with, which is going to make a lot of variety beers in return.
You have new things coming up from White Labs. It's not just the dry yeast. You recently gone over to the new package of pure pitch yeast, or next generation pure pitch packages with the screw top, which is super easy to use. But I worked close to with a homebrew supply store in Sweden, and there's been a lot of talks that people are some homebrewers have been why it was so good with this, to make starters and stuff like that, and why did they have to change? So it would be fun to hear White Labs' sides of the story. Why did you change to the next gen packs? And I think some people are some of the old homebrewers that's been around for they are now it was so easy calculating cell counts with the old packages, how much you had and stuff like that. And now going over to this, an easy change for White Labs to do?
Was it easy? Chris White never likes doing anything easy. Even if it's just to improve quality a minuscule amount, he will have the company and all of us invest so much time and resources into doing it. Pure Pitch was great. There was nothing wrong with it. But we, through R&D, came out with changes to the packaging, changes to the film that extended the shelf life of the yeast and made it higher quality. There's micro perforations that allow it to off gas. There's a cap, which is just easier to use. It's easier to sanitize. It's easier to deal with. And, when it comes to change in homebrewing, we're all homebrewers and passionate about what we do, and it's just like having a hobby of anything or enjoying a sports team. If your favorite player gets traded, or it's just something to talk about. And I think that's why we all enjoy it, because it takes us away from the reality of our lives and the real things that we need to talk about. I don't think a yeast supplier putting a cap on a package requires somebody to lose sleep, but it does improve the quality. And you know, home brewers and professional brewers have been asking for more and more yeast. Yep. It seems like every 5 years somebody wants more yeast. So we were able to double our pitch, and in return, if we were already going to redesign a package, we might as well add other improvements, such as easy to use and the perforations to increase shelf life as well.
Yeah. So it's a higher cell count in the new package and a higher viability as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So these old calculators that calculate, you know, best before dates, the cell counts. I heard some like almost some positive rumors that there was actually more cells alive after the best before date on White Labs pure pitch packages than a lot of the online calculators say.
Yeah.
If you put in the calculators with manufacture dates and stuff like that actually the viability is much, much better than calculated. Have you ever tried that?
Or we've seen that as the case for over a decade.
All right.
Yeah. These calculators, you know, were built in the mid to late 2000s a lot of times. Yeah. when the yeast wasn't as great of quality. And they're rules of thumb, right? And we have done trials and calculated viability over time, and you can see that on whitelabs.com and some of our blog posts as we introduce new packaging and new yeast strains and all that. But it is very strain dependent. You know, we have our internal specs on how things need to be when we package them. But when you look at yeast, if you look at it under a microscope, each strain looks different. Some cells, like California ale yeast, are very fat and hearty, right? And you might get a monastery type strain that's a little bit smaller. What that means is when a strain is physically larger, it has more glycogen reserves, has more reserve carbohydrates. And as you don't feed it, as you store it, it begins to deplete those over long periods of time. So when you start with a small strain, it's going to deplete. It's going to have less to deplete. So strains like lager strains and Belgian strains tend to not hold up as well as some of the ale strains, some of the English strains. Fortunately, when it comes to Belgian strains, you know, those are workhorses. You can throw those into a fermentation at almost any pitch rate and into wort at any pitch rate and still have a pretty expressive active fermentation. So it's some of the lager strains when you start getting past that best by date that concern me a little bit more. But if you have a California ale yeast and it's past the expiration, there's a really good chance that you still have a good fermentation from it. Yeah. Because of the size of those cells.
But is the need for making a starter like reduced, you believe, now with the new packages and the higher?
Yeah, I honestly think it was reduced before. But you know, as a brewer, you're going to see a decreased lag time and quicker fermentation activity with a starter, right? You are pitching more yeast, but you're more so pitching active yeast, most likely. If 12 hours before, the night before you brew, you make a starter, that yeast is, you're essentially krausening your beer, right? You're taking an active wort, an active yeast culture, and inoculating your wort with it. Whereas yeast from a lab that's in a pure pitch has been in your fridge, it's been dormant, right? We package it so that it can stay a little dormant. And it just takes a little bit longer to wake up. It's not really going to change your fermentation very much other than a couple hours of your airlock bubbling or not. You know, but I think some people enjoy the activity of making a starter the night before, right?
Yeah, I think so too. You know, people think it's kind of cozy.
Yeah.
Bring out your flask and your stir plate the night before and start cultivating. I can agree to one part, but yeah, as I said before in the podcast, that I also think, you know, maybe that yeast companies should do the propagating and we homebrewers should not do it because we don't have the same, as we saw during the walk, we don't have the same sanitary.
Not really.
Yeah, that's a risk. But you know, homebrew, fortunately, I would guess there's a lot of contaminated homebrew out there where there's other organisms outside of the yeast that are, you know, getting in your fermenter, in your bucket, in your carboy, in your rack and cane, your siphon, whatever you're processing your beer with. There's likely other organisms in that, as much as you want to sanitize and clean. But fortunately, you're always keeping it cold, hopefully, and you're probably consuming it very quick.
Yeah.
So if there's any issue, you're probably going to drink that before you even perceive it. Now, if you're aging something for 6 to 12 months, maybe you will see an issue if you have some contamination. But if it's a blonde beer and it's, you know, June or July and it's nice and warm out and you want to share beers, you go through 5 gallons or 20 liters pretty quick.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'll try to stay a metric for everybody.
No.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate it. But in one way, I think a lot of listeners are in some extent used to, you know, American homebrew. Like, we know what 5 gallons is.
And
stuff like that.
You know, mostly.
But and this, I was really happy because I saw that you have this the vault that you release special yeast sometimes, and now you released one of my favorite, I think, the German Lager X, for example.
Oh, comes great!
Seasonal yeasts,
mm-hmm.
and how do you work with that? You know, choosing new strains. Do you just call a brewery and say, "Hey guys, can we steal your yeast?" Or I guess it's maybe some company secrets there. But how does that work when a yeast company like White Labs choose a new yeast? I guess it's not like you just take it and grow it and sell it. You do some trials. How does this, you know, age in our plant or how is that work plan?
Yeah, so we have about 500 strains cryogenically frozen.
Right.
We have about 80 that are commercially available, which, if you ask me, is insane. You can never go to a brewery and say there's 80 beers on tap. Just logistically, from a manufacturer, very difficult. But it's home brewers that keep that alive, right? And pro brewers buy a wide variety of strains, but by volume and quantity, they're buying the same 10 strains, most of them, right? So these other 70 strains are ways of encouraging creativity, encouraging people to make beers that aren't the same. So we've accumulated these strains over the decades from different ways. Some of them are from working with breweries. We just released a lactobacillus blend called Acid Trip, which was a collaboration with a brewery called Tripping Animals in Florida, big hype brewery. And they banked this blend with us for quite a while. And we would always propagate it and use it. And through conversations and through a couple beers, it was like, what if we released that? Yeah. You know, that would be cool.
Yeah.
And now it's in the vault. We did a one-off release and had some inventory, and now it's available for anybody to order it with a certain amount of lead time. With homebrewers, it can vary a little bit, but we try to release those more seasonally. Yeah. And then there's stories of, you know, a couple of years ago, Chris White did a RV trip across the Southwest, and he ended up coming back with this brown wet bag. And I was like, what do you have in this bag? And he goes, I was sitting at a brewery under a pear tree, and a pear fell right next to me and hit the arm of the chair that I was sitting on and cracked open in half. So he grabbed it, he brought it back, and so there's no way we're going to find yeast on this. Well, there was yeast on it, and there was yeast that was suitable for wort, right? And that's always something to look at too, is there's a lot of yeast out there, but it doesn't mean that you can brew beer with it. It doesn't mean that it's alcohol tolerant, or maybe it wants really simple sugar, you know, that's available in fruit, but wort and beer tends to have slightly more complex sugars, and the carbohydrates can be di- and trisaccharides, right? So it's not just one single molecule of sugar, it could be multiple. And brewer's yeast have been domesticated to break those down, where some wild yeast hasn't, but this strain that was found on that pear could. and now it sits in our vault. And hopefully someday, you know, we get our R&D brewing team gets the itch to brew with it, or maybe it starts in the lab occasionally, and then the lab will say, hey, can we do that? Sometimes it starts with the brewer or sales, and sometimes it starts with education. There's a very open culture of innovation at White Labs, and sometimes the ideas for these strains and cultures come from a lot of different places. And sometimes it's just a new yeast blend of strains that we have too. You know, I really like this strain and this strain and this strain. Let's blend them together and see how it goes.
Yeah. And what about, we had a little bit of discussion before, but you know, the new like thing in brewing, at least in Sweden and Europe, has been this talk about thiols. This little thing in hops that's that people are trying to release into their beers by using thiol releasing yeasts.
That is the, if you just want another beer, you could just say it. You don't have to do this whole setup about
I try to
thiols
melt it in. So.
That's the sound we're talking about.
Yeah.
So, you know, thiols are these bound aroma compounds, right? And they're not able to be volatilized, and they're pretty much neutral, right? So what's been found is they're are enzymes in certain yeast strains, or you know, very active enzymes in certain yeast strains, that will release these terpenes and give you more hop aroma. Occasionally you will see more sulfur as well, because it's often that these terpenes are bound to sulfur. So what we did is we performed R&D on our whole catalog, and we found which strains were able to release these thiols more than others.
Yeah.
What we found was a lot of Belgian strains did it really well.
Yeah.
But nobody wants to brew a hazy IPA with Belgian yeast. Yeah. So some of the lager strains also did really well. And there might be some strain releases in the near future if you keep an eye on our website and social media for that. But what we did with this 077 Tropicale yeast blend, because we found strains that were great for hazy IPAs and that were able to release these bound thiols as well. There is some genetic modification going on within the yeast industry as well. White Labs has no GMO strains in our catalog. As Europeans, it's probably more of a topic or problematic than domestically.
We can't you can't sell GMO modified yeasts in Europe, I think.
It's against the law.
Yeah, it's against the law.
We're wild and loose out here. So
Yeah.
But White Labs doesn't have any.
We can't brew beer with weed either.
Yeah, we can't legally either. So even CBD is frowned upon.
All right. Yeah.
Some craft brewers pushed that for quite a while before our feds came down on that. But so what we did though is we found which strains had that enzymatic activity naturally, and I, from a very biased standpoint, actually prefer it, because I think too much of one thing is not always a positive. You know, if you want this tropical fruit flavor, sometimes I feel like maybe add a little bit of the fruit itself as opposed to trying to coax so much out of a certain ingredient. But what you'll see is this awesome subtle expression of tropical fruit notes such as passion fruit, guava, mango, pineapple. But it really depends on the hops used too. So a lot of these trendier, more modern hops, I say trendy and modern, it's 10 years ago, but like your Simcoe Citra, this Nelson, right? Those have a lot of free thiols already.
Oh yeah.
And so a benefit of using these strains is almost to use cheaper hops, like a lot of Cascade, Centennial, Chinook.
I heard. Saz is also.
Which could be great.
Yeah.
But you're also brewing a American IPA with saws, so you know, I think it depends on what process and ingredients you want to use. But you could see these side by side. So the one on the right, I believe, is the Tropicale yeast blend, and then the one on the left is London Fog, which is a much more textbook strain used for hazy IPAs.
Yeah, I believe I felt a bit more esters in the right one. Almost going to the Belgium side that you said.
Yeah, there's no Belgian yeast in this one, but it's definitely more expressive, and I think a little more like
More of the like stone fruits and peach stuff, and not the tropical.
A little more tart esters. Too.
Yeah. Both were really good, but using the tropical ale, do you have any like preferred brewing methods, or how should you? Because somebody says that you have to put, you know, the hops in the mash.
You can,
but it has to also be good, because releasing thiols, as I understand, is are super potent. That if you have like for commercial brewers, that if you handle this yeast right, you can lower your hop rate and still get, you know, the same, which is good for, because they are hunting money, you know. So is there any, do you have any like pinpointers on how to use your hop rates and stuff using the tropical ale yeast?
You know, I've read a lot of research papers and white papers on different thiolized yeast and bound thiols in beer and how to get them. But my experience is that most brewers aren't using the logic that you just laid out. They're wanting more of everything.
All right.
Right. And craft brewers probably should be thinking about their costs a little bit more, but they're looking at, I love this flavor, I can get more of it. I'm not necessarily going to decrease the amount I'm using. Well, maybe in theory you could, but I think sometimes that would be very hard to dial in, especially on a homebrew scale. These compounds are very volatile and they're very difficult to measure. It has to be sent to a specific lab. I believe we send it to a lab in France to measure, and they don't always package well either. So some of the quantifiable numbers that we get back, can skew and deteriorate fairly quickly. So I haven't seen a lot of people using it to create the same product using less ingredients. I've seen people using it to try to get more flavor using the same amount of ingredients.
All right.
But I fundamentally agree with you that I wish more people would look at it. If my yeast costs are the same, no matter what strain I'm using, and I can contract a bunch of, like I said, saws or, you know, less desirable hop and save a couple bucks a pound, that's probably a pretty good way to look at it. But are you getting that same result, right? And there's a lot of sensory ways that you could do that, or maybe just develop a new brand that people aren't recognizing as supposed to taste like something.
These cans we have here on the table, are you selling them in stores like this with two different yeast?
We've done very limited distribution. We can about a pallet of each. You know, you're talking about 80 cases. It's not very much. So we'll sell it through our tap rooms, and that's generally about it. We'd bring it to a lot of different events. The cans are nice because kegs are difficult and expensive to ship. So we've sent our beer to Europe for beer festivals before, which is pretty cool. But we're just selling these in the tap room for the time being. It's just a way for guests and fans to take the beer to go. We'll be pouring this hazy IPA at the Homebrew Con welcome reception, industry welcome reception tonight, and then we have some kegs down there that we'll be pouring the rest of the week too.
Do you always, when you do split batches, do you always do like two compared to quite similar yeasts, like two lager yeasts, or do you split it and do like a lager yeast and I don't know, Belgian blonde yeast, and like as an educational thing as well, or is it?
Yeah, it depends on what the purpose of the batch is. In our tap rooms, we used to be so strictly R&D'd, it was at the cost of the quality of the beer. You know, scientists that were making it, and they wanted to see the data. They wanted it to taste good, but you know, when you start seeing people come in and they're having a beer at the bar and they enjoy it, that's kind of a plus. And what I tended to see was when we were doing four different strains side by side, we would have, say, cowl ale, English ale, Hefeweizen and a Belgian yeast and a base pale ale. And what do you think the first two to go were? Cowl ale and English, right? Yeah. For a pale ale. And so you would be left with these oddball beers that, that tasted kind of okay on their own, but really lost themselves without that anchor, right? That control. What we have on tap right now, though, that, that will be featured at HomebrewCon, I'll be sitting on a panel on Friday, probably in the past for everybody listening to this, but it probably will be available through the American Homebrewers Association if you sign up and get a membership, that's on brewing local. So, you know, California is one of the largest agricultural states in the United States. And because it's such an expensive place to live, we tend to only grow crops that are very valuable. But you can grow so much here. So the challenge we had, we worked with a homebrew club called Quaff, who shout out wins, you know, homebrew club of the year quite a bit at different competitions. And we challenged all the homebrewers to brew what they could describe as local as possible. Because we had, through the San Diego Brewers Guild, we had conversations, what is a local beer to San Diego? We don't grow barley. We don't grow hops. We have our own water that's taken from Northern California, so it's very hard by the time it gets down here. And we have local yeast. You know, we're sitting in the yeast lab, but how do we make a local beer here? And we said, what better way and what more innovative way to do it than pose the question to a homebrew club? We could define it, but maybe it's not going to resonate with people brewing it. So we had about 20 brewers submit beers, and we had them submit a story with it. Most homebrew competitions, you know, you judge the beer, and that advances or not, and that's what you score. But we scored more heavily on the story of the beer than the actual beer itself, because we realized maybe you want to use local oranges. There's a ton of citrus in San Diego. I've got a big orange tree in my backyard, but maybe it's the wrong season that we're doing this competition. So, you know, we would let them use another orange peel, knowing, hey, I've got one in my backyard. I would love to use that, but here's the essence of what this beer would be. And one of the beers that ended up coming from it, we were able to brew here, and it used a local yeast that was found in an inland valley here about, I don't know, 10 miles from here. And it was a microbiologist by trade who homebrews and was able to bring the yeast. This one we actually brewed at Pure Project, but we did four beers around town with different breweries, which was really cool. So the beer that we did for HomebrewCon is this panel with, you know, we've got a maltster. We've got somebody who works with a lot of local ag and farms. Then we have somebody from Dr. Bronner's, which, are y'all familiar? Dr. Bronner's is a soap company locally, but they've been around for decades. And they're very, they're a B Corp, and they're very about ethically sustaining farms. And so they're going to lend a great perspective on, you know, how do they work with farms and produce crops that are ethical to the area. So what we did with this blonde ale is we used Admiral Malt, which is a California grown and malted barley, which I believe they're the only ones doing it, at least to a craft scale, and very minimal hops from the Pacific Northwest, because that's still where most of them grow. But you can't grow hops in San Diego, it's just expensive. And then we use local yeast, obviously, from our lab here, water from the city water that we treated, and then honey from a farm about 15 miles north. So it's, in my eyes, as about local to San Diego as you can get, which is going to be really cool to try. And long story short, because I remember where you asked me what made me think of that, is in that beer we use California ale yeast, and then I believe 550 Belgian ale yeast as well. So trying those side by side are very starkly different.
Yeah, okay. Cool. Have you ever considered, because I guess in the homebrew sized packages that you can buy, is it always the same cell count in those, independent if it's like a kale ale yeast or if it's like a Hefeweizen yeast or British yeast?
It is, and that took a long time to standardize.
Okay,
and so we package at 2.5 billion cells per mil, and when you're propagating yeast, it concentrates differently. Mm-hmm. So there's certain strains that we yield a lot of yeast from. And when you talk to our planning team, like, why don't we just sell a crap ton of this one? We make a ton of it, right? Yeah, whereas a, you know, that would be more of an English type strain. Whereas a Hefeweizen strain doesn't flocculate and concentrate very well. So we don't yield a lot of it.
Mm.
So our planners are like, make more, sell more of this. We only need one vessel to make this. We need three to make this.
Yeah.
But through our concentration and packaging process, we package them all consistently, which then gives the brewer, in theory, the ability to adjust their pitch rate from there.
Okay. Okay. Because that was the reason for why I asked. So some types of beer, it's like a consensus that you always want to underpitch it.
Yeah.
And some you don't want to underpitch. So would it make sense to sell like Hefeweizen yeast pack with a lower cell count compared to a Kale Ale yeast?
Yeah. It does make sense to do that, but it's when we're making 80 plus strains, it's just very difficult.
Yeah.
You know, there's just the nature of just, you know, making yeast is, you kind of find that middle ground that works the best for all strains. But
yeah,
in theory, I think that would be really cool. You know, we do have an online calculator that you can adjust your pitch rate to desired. You know, it'll say, you know, half a pouch or whatever, but realistically, it's going to be really difficult to measure that.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to have to pour it off into something, and then I would say pitch the whole damn thing and have a good time.
Now, I thought it was great because I brew some Belgian saison. I re-ferment in the bottle, and I thought that this is kind of genius because with the new packages, I can pitch almost everything and I can save some and try to squeeze out the air and save it and then brew the beer, ferment it, clear it, and then re-yeast it with the same yeast when I repackage.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
I thought that was, you know, and that's been hard doing in a sanitized way with the older packages or other packages, I would say. But another maybe stupid question, when you because you the cultivation in house here, you make your wort for that in house. We heard Chris White talking about that you almost use a pressure cooker almost.
Mm-hmm.
You boil it under pressure, but is it always the same like base, or do you just take what malt you have in hand, or is it always the same? It's always 1040, mm-hmm. and it's always 100% Pilsner malt. And
so this specifics of the composition of our wort is proprietary.
Yeah.
With that said, we've got 45,000 pounds silo of domestic two-row barley out there. Okay. So, but you know, we do have some strains that do want different prop wort. There's some wine strains, some you know, different strains that people prefer not to be grown on gluten. But the majority of our strains are grown on the same propagation wort, and it's very similar to what you're describing. There's specific nutrients. We do have the ability to pressurize our kettle, which is very unique, which is going to help us boil at a slightly higher temperature, just ensuring we're killing anything off. But the majority of it's you know, this the same recipe day to day to day, and then there's some exceptions here and there for other strains.
What about the future? Do you know if White Labs have you mentioned here that you maybe have a thiol releasing lager yeasts coming up? Is there anything else that's you would say is going to be a game changer?
Game changer? I think it depends on what brewers want to brew. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of strains that we've been very excited about.
Yeah.
That tend to not be met with as much excitement, even though it's really a passion project for us. And then there's other things and other trends like Kvike, right? Kvike has been popularized commercially, but it was homebrewers that kicked that off, and it was about a year ahead of any professional brewers really using it and even asking us about it. And we, you know, we always have strains that are going through R&D. You know, as I mentioned, we've been working with pizza dough a lot and developing house cultures for that. We have a lager yeast blend that we're actually working with Clawhammer Brewing Supply, if you're familiar with them. And hopefully going to be releasing that sometime this year as well. That's meant for hoppy beers, for IPLs, cold IPAs, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
What about yeast for non-alcoholic beers?
We already have some in our catalog.
Have one, right?
Yeah, we had probably four or five for years, and there just wasn't a lot of people asking for it here and there. But we did do a lot more R&D to commercialize the strain. You know, something we had in the bank and we would send out a couple times a year. But when that trend has really started to hit, we had a lot more craft brewers asking for it. We put a lot more time into to developing it and getting to understand it. So we released NA All Day, which is just kind of a playful name of non-alcoholic beer that you can drink all day and, you know, not get drunk. And that strain is maltose negative. So maltose being the primary sugar available in wort, it cannot consume that. So you'd pitch it into a very, very low gravity wort. It's going to produce a little bit of ethanol, but it's going to leave you essentially with a non-alcoholic beer or very low ABV beer, depending on your process and where you live.
But is it available for home brewers as well, or is it more for craft breweries?
I'm not sure.
Because I'm pretty sure I bought some...
We've released it for homebrewers.
Could it be something like Jacob?
It's NA All Day is the strain name.
Oh, okay.
Anytime we release something, we will release quantities of homebrew as well.
Yeah. Okay.
Whether it's in our year-round catalog, I don't know off the top of my head.
Right.
But it is available with the right quantity and the right, you know, the vault's always open if there's enough pre-orders for the homebrewers.
Yeah. Because I think there's been discussions that if you're a home brewer and you want to make non-alcoholic beer and you use those kinds of yeast strains,
you package them.
You package it, and there's a risk that you introduce other bacteria or yeasts that you may have.
Yeah.
And so it's risky if you want to like drink it and drive. And I mean, there it might be alcoholic, or it's hard to measure for a homebrew that is actually.
What I've heard, they suggest that you have to pasteurize.
You have to stabilize somehow.
You can use exactly. You can use konserveringsmedel,
potassium metasulfate.
And benzoate.
I mean, I wouldn't have any personal recommendations for that, but I think I would be more concerned with pathogens. So I think that my two cents would be ensuring that you're acidifying below 4.6 pH, because yes, it's scary if you get some brewer's yeast in there. I would be more worried about hurting myself through an exploding bottle.
Yeah.
But if you're above, right, because you don't have a lot of fermentation happening, so you're not going to have a big pH drop. If you don't have that big pH drop, which is a big concern in draft systems serving non-alcoholic beer, and you have, you know, some pathogen from somebody that was serving that was sick, then it could get in the wort and then make somebody else sick. So that to me is a bigger concern. Mm. But it's ensuring that you really acidify it, which is going to taste better anyways. I mean, nobody wants a 5 pH beer or near beer.
Yeah. And what about the... I recently had a discussion with a brewer who was scared of, you know, bringing home a saison yeast to his brewery because it was diastatic. Mm-hmm. And I said, it's okay. You're a home brewer. What do you take on the yeast or the enzyme that's diastatic?
Yeah.
How do you get rid of that at home? Is it like easy for us to clean, or do we have to be concerned about it as homebrewers?
It's as easy as anything else. Yeah. So if you have good cleaning and sanitation practices, you've got nothing to worry about. Brewers have been using these strains for hundreds of years, right? These Saccharomyces variant diastatic strains, these STA1 positive. And what it really means is it has an enzyme that's going to break down dextrins, long chain sugars, and then make them fermentable. So you can have a secondary fermentation, which maybe you don't want, and it's going to continue to create CO2 and ethanol. And if you've already packaged, that could be problematic. And there was a big conversation a couple of years ago with some commercial breweries having issues. And, you know, the brewers worth their weight in salt weren't worried about it. And the ones that were worried about it probably have bigger concerns than just one specific yeast strain.
what would you say is the... let me think about how I should pose this question. So let's say you're a home brewer and you've made your wort. What are the critical points you need to consider to for the fermentation process as a home brewer? Because so you supply the yeast, you sell the yeast, and for your yeast to function properly, what do we have to do as home brewers?
Oxygenation is probably the biggest differentiator between mediocre beer and great beer. Okay, the old homebrew shake where you're aerating your carboy, that's how I personally brew at home. I don't have an aeration stone, right? But knowing how yeast perform and the environment they prefer about 8 to 12 ppm of dissolved oxygen in the fermenter. That's very difficult to achieve on a homebrew level for so many reasons. Generally, the temperature of our wort isn't cool enough, so the solubility of oxygen with warm wort is difficult, right? When it's cold, it's able to dissolve easier. The way to measure it is pretty much impossible at home. You know, these O2 meters and the ppm range are about $2,000. And when you're homebrew shaking, the maximum dissolved oxygen you can get is about 4.5 to 5 ppm, right? Because you're using air, right? And oxygen is only a small percentage of the air that we breathe, but pure O2 can really give that higher level. So even if you can't measure it, just injecting pure oxygen will generally give the yeast, will make the yeast a lot happier, will allow it to build up its cell walls and replicate and build up sterile and fatty acids to harden itself to get ready to go into fermentation. Yeast don't like fermentation. We do, right? Yeah. Yeast want oxygen. Yeast like what we do here at White Labs. We give it a lot of oxygen and a lot of nutrients. When we ferment with it, it becomes very stressed and it starts putting out all these byproducts as a stress mechanism. It wants to take this environment and make it exclusive for itself, right? So it starts producing ethanol. But when oxygen's present, it's happy. It's what it wants. So just ensuring that it has adequate oxygen, however method that can be on the homebrew scale, I think is a really great way of ensuring you're going to have a hearty, good fermentation, even over a yeast starter. So if you're going to invest time and money into equipment, look into an aeration stone.
How about nutrition to add that to your wort? Do you believe that is...
Yeah, nutrition
always good.
Yeah, nutrients can be great. I think it's a good rule of thumb. It's not always necessary, but where it can be, where wort can be deficient is in zinc. So, you know, when it comes to nitrogen and in the form of amino acids, barley has a lot of it and has much more than the yeast need generally. But it can be deficient in zinc, which can help with the conversion of acetaldehyde to ethanol. And so adding nutrients that are high in zinc can be preferable, but I would say if it's not a high gravity and you don't plan on using the yeast, you don't always need nutrients, but nutrients aren't very expensive. And if you want to toss some in for each one of your batches just to ensure it has everything it needs, if it doesn't need it, it's going to fall out in your tube, right? It's not going to be detrimental to your beer. But you know, it's a couple extra bucks depending on what style of beer you're brewing. I personally use it in all my batches.
Okay. Good to know. Magnus, you use pure zinc in your...
I use usually pure zinc in the fermenter, yeah.
That's great. That's even better than hot side.
So I use that in all my beers and a little less in lager strains than when using ales. Ales needs more zinc.
In your... like pressure cooking that or
the sink?
Yeah.
No, I bought zinc heptahydrate. Uh-huh. It's like a salt, and I need so little. So I have made a diluted it. I took like 0.1 gram of that into 1 liter or one quart of distilled water to make, you know, a liquid solution. And that I use 0.5 milliliter per batch. So I have.
I have a life supply.
So I add that to my, and I'm not. It's, you know, water with nothing in. So I'm not. I don't do anything to it. I just have a pipette and I just drop it in because I usually brew small batch and I'm. And that's the, you know, the good part about being a home brewer is that I drink it fast. So if I have any contaminates, it won't be able to. It's gone when it starts to express.
Yeah,
and I don't have to be. I don't have any regulations from the. From the government that my beer should have a specific, and I can just pour it out if I'm not happy. So yeah, that's how I do it.
Yeah, my problem is I'll often start drinking the batch, and when I get halfway through it 2 weeks later, I'm like, damn, now it's starting to taste really good.
Yeah, I've been there, done that.
Yeah, so sometimes I just get too excited.
Yeah, the last bottle is the best one.
Yeah, it happens quite a bit to me.
Yeah, that's great. And
cool. Well, it's been great chatting with all of you.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for taking your time.
Much.
Super stoked to see this. It's been like on the bucket list to visit White Labs in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, hopefully we can all hang out downstairs with some beers, and I'll buy all some pizza if you're hungry too.
Quake pizza. I have to go home and try that.
Yeah.
I made a pizza once with yeast that I already ferment a beer with.
Yeah.
It was the only yeast I had at home. It became pretty bitter.
Yeah. Yeah. It depends what beer you pull it from, but any hop material in that slurry is gonna do that, right? It's not so much the yeast; it's just the plant matter that's actually harvested in your slurry. But that, I mean, that's how the relationship between bakers and brewers has been for hundreds of years. It's sharing yeast. And, you know, I think it's really cool that we're able to still connect that. And it's something that we're all very proud of. And it seems silly because it's, you know, it's pizza and it's really good pizza. But I think it's just bringing back that historical connection that often gets overlooked.
Yeah.
How would we do, if we want to go home and, make a Quake pizza, how should we do?
So our recipe, so if you want to know anything more about White Labs, our Instagram accounts, White Labs Yeast is our primary account, but our brewery, White Labs Brewing Co., has a couple sub accounts as well. WhiteLabs.com has all the information on brewing, whether it's beer, wine, kombucha, spirits, but WhiteLabsBrewingCo.com has some of our more geeky public facing data. So we have beer sheets that are linked on both websites for every one of our beers. You can get fermentation timelines, you can get recipes. These beers in front of us today, you can learn almost anything you want about these beers, from the lab data to the recipe to what the fermentation looked like, which is really cool. We're open source everything. And we have a scaled down home version of our pizza dough on whitelabsbrewingco.com as well.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. Yes.
Yeah. I think that it's not, how would you say that about Quake, that my, as I think that the Quake is almost bigger here in the United States than it is in like Sweden and Norway. Not a lot of homebrewers use it. And and when I read about it, I read about articles from American magazines about brewing, and not so much in Sweden. It feels like, you know, they are more interested in Quake here in the States than probably too close in Sweden.
Yeah,
you know,
I could see that.
Mm-hmm. But you know, the guy Lars Marius writes, the Norwegian guy, writes a lot in Craft Beer Magazine about.
He's done a lot. Yeah.
Since it never becomes warmer than 15 degrees in Sweden. So.
Well, I mean, it depends on what temperature you knock out at, right?
It's cool. We can only brew lagers at home. It's
I don't know. San Diego's like what? Probably 21 degrees.
Yeah.
Almost every day. So.
Yeah. All right.
Cool. Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you, Eric.
Yeah, that was awesome. I really appreciate it.
So,
talk to you later.
Talk to you in 2 weeks. There will be a new episode about something else.
Yeah.
Probably beer related.
Yeah, probably homebrewing.
Or pizza.
Right?
It's the pizza podcast now.
Okay, thanks.
Yep, thanks.
Hallelujah.
Cheers.